The Spinoff Podcast Network.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spinoff. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spinoff member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
You're listening to Business is Boring, a podcast that reckons it's anything but. Business is Boring is brought to you by Spark Lab, offering inspiration and practical advice to help businesses find their edge. To hear more about Spark Lab, including details about the latest events, workshops, and business tools, visit sparklab.co.nz. And now, here's your host, Simon Pound.
Kia ora koutou katoa. Welcome to Business is Boring. In Aotearoa, New Zealand, we import over 400,000 tonne of new plastic and send up to 330,000 tonne of used plastic to landfill every year. It doesn't make a lot of sense. This is recyclable, valuable material wasted. Critical are a company out to change this. They make things like table and bench tops, partitions and other feature materials for building from plastic waste, upcycling it into beautiful, low-carbon and endlessly recyclable materials. They've built out the business, partnered with a bunch of great brands and projects, and are working to create more pathways and opportunities. Co-founder and CEO Rui Peng joins us now to talk their journey making something new and overcoming everything the world can throw at them, right down to tornadoes. Tēnā koe, thank you for being here.
Tēnā koe hoa. I love the enthusiasm of that intro, bro. It definitely makes me want to listen to what you have to say, bro.
Love what you're up to. I think a lot of people would have seen bits and bobs of what you've been up to recently, the Kingi collaboration on the chopping boards, and anyone who's been to Commercial Bay would have seen the beautiful Kōkako cafe installation that your company's worked on. So it's such a treat to get to chat to you today.
Kia ora, bro. Lovely to meet you, bro. I'll give a real quick mihi. So kia ora koutou, ko Puke Tāpapa te maunga, ko te auanga te awa, ko Pung tuku tipunga, ko Manchu Raua, ko Han oku iwi. Cross the South, took Kainga, no China, Ho, Groping, took Ingwa. So kia ora, bro. Bit of a background. Our whānau live in Puke Tāpapa, where the Puke Tāpapa is our maunga, and Te Oanga, Oakley Creek, is our awa. Our whānau actually from, I'm Chinese, but I get mistaken lots to be Māori, probably as the co-founder of a Māori-owned business. My business partner, Adam, he's Ngāti Raukawa and Ngāti Kahununu. So, it's between him and I suppose Critical have a, I suppose we're all on a learning journey ourselves, but we do identify ourselves, and having a kaupapa that wants to outwork kaitiakitanga and being good ancestors. So tēnā koe, bro. I really appreciate the space that you've created, or you fellas have created, and having us share some of our whakaro and over this kōrero, bro. So awesome to be here, bro.
Well, thank you for being here. And to take it back to the beginning, you studied and taught architecture, right? What got you into being interested in buildings and materials, and really interested to dig a bit further into all of those principles that you bring to the company later too?
Oh, beautiful, bro. I love the joke that my dreams as an architect didn't work out. So instead of that, I get to live vicariously through the dreams of being an architect through my mates and through our products. But I suppose I think architecture, growing up, did a lot of art. My mum, she was an immigrant, but she was, when she was back in China, she was a mechanical engineer. My dad was like a geologist sort of thing. Growing up, did a lot of art and design and kind of tinkered away with, technologies. And while I was at uni, built my own CNC machine and 3D printers and stuff. So I suppose in many ways it's kind of, it was sort of the coming together of having quite a creative upbringing in that sense. That led me to study architecture.
And what led you to the interest in sustainability of the materials? It's almost like that kind of, tip of the iceberg kind of thing where everyone's very aware of the amount of plastic waste that they create when they come home from the supermarket with 100 different packets and stuff, right? Yeah. But it's construction and the building industry that's a massive majority contributor to our landfill problem, right?
So there's probably two stories on that, bro. The first story is I think I did my architecture degree. I worked for a firm for 10 months. And I remember sitting, I think I was, at the time, 23. I was sitting in the architecture firm. This would have been about, 10 years ago, 11 years ago. I'm 34, shucks. 11 or 10 years ago. You know, for designers or architects of, you know, our generation, I don't know how old you are, bro, but I'm just going to extend that our generation. Sustainability and, like, there's a massive growing awareness to having beautiful spaces but that are also durable and have minimal impact on the environment. So 10 years ago, like, while there were some structures that existed to pave the way, it wasn't prominent, right? So I remember being a young architecture graduate. We were working for a fit-out for a Far North airport, and I was thinking to myself, man, like, I really want to design a beautiful space that is uber or super refined, but I also want it to be really sustainable and good for the planet. And there just wasn't any options there. I could have chosen a material that was beautiful, like stone or engineered stone, but the carbon impact of that was so high and the waste would just go straight to landfill. Or I could choose a sustainable product. At the time, there wasn't really many there as options, but the ones that I could find were, you know, pretty ugly, pretty unrefined, and didn't really quite fit the creative vision. So I suppose that's one of the, you know, I guess that's one part of the fuck-a-papa of critical. Like, we wanted something that didn't exist, so why not make it and build the technology to do it ourselves? The second part of it, bro, is I stumbled into critical. I even stumbled into business. So I was mentoring a group of young people where the school system didn't really work out for too well. We did it for about 3 years with the goal of teaching them how to use design and 3D printing and entrepreneurship to start their own companies, and just quickly learned that if we wanted to continue this impact over the long term, over a long period of time, we actually have to create a scalable business with a great model to actually employ them and scaffold them into meaningful work. So we were making products, including furniture at the time. 2018 hits. China stopped buying the rest of the world's plastics through the Green Wall ban, and people started bringing us their materials, their plastics, and we effectively, over the next 4 years, that the R&D took over intermediate school and, you know, built the first generation of the technology of what we know as clean stone today. So stumbled into this, bro, and completely accidental.
By stumbled, you mean worked really hard, long, iterated, solved every problem.
Yeah, fair enough.
And tell us about the clean stone kind of hero product. As if people have seen it or if they've got it in their head, it looks kind of beautiful, like marble, and it has a kind of matte and, you know, stone, you know, feel to it, right? And can be quite a long way away from what people might think about if they think about soft plastics or plastic kind of, you know, things like barriers for, roadworks or road cones or some of the more traditional uses of soft plastics. So how did you get to such a kind of cool, refined product? Yeah. And, yeah, what was the process to get there?
Yeah, I guess we took a very customer-centric approach in the development of clean stone. So one of the things we observed, I mean, if this is a fair observation, or my opinion, was that when 2018 sort of happened and China stopped being the world's biggest customer for, you know, recycled materials, what the traditional business model for recyclers is that they take a product, a waste product that's already of low value, they add a whole bunch of value to it. They will shred it, they will clean it, they will pelletize it into little resins, and then they have to go and sell it to other manufacturers. Now, the issue is the manufacturers that they were selling it mostly to are all injection molded, mass-produced, single-used products. So that product on the other side was still high volume and low value. And one observation can be made is that, you know, if it's not observed carefully, our recycling infrastructure is a bit of a race to the bottom in terms of having to, and it doesn't incentivize us to do any, you know, anything else of our plastics, eh? Because the economics didn't make sense. The economy of the circular economy, back when we observed, didn't make sense. So having a background in design and architecture and in design thinking, and entrepreneurship is the coming together of desirability, feasibility, and viability. And desirability is the human-centered element that you can effectively spend millions of dollars to build a really beautiful technology and have it, you know, and have it change the world. But if you've got customers that don't understand it and don't want it, then you've kind of wasted your money building a rocket ship that you don't really know where you're going to take it to. So I suppose for us, you know, I was the first customer that I designed this really for myself and for my mates who cared about sustainability and who cared about beautiful architecture. And that process of refining the taste and creating little prototypes and pitching it to them and getting their feedback, and that continuous iteration over 5 years or 4 or 5 years to ensure that we actually had customers, it solves a real problem that gave us then the confidence and the backing to then, you know, raise our friends and family and now about to close a seed investment round. So, yeah.
And those product use cases, like, yeah tell us about that as like the bench tops and the like, where it looks like kind of, you know, a marble from the future or something, right? Which is really cool. They're real statement pieces. Like they're adding a lot to the story of the places you're working with, right?
So it's hard to describe sort of over podcast, but basically, you know, the clean stone is effectively like a slab of decorated, maybe the closest, one close view is that it can look like a terrazzo or it can look like a hyper-refined, you know, like neutral panel, like a marble or a stone. It's got the ability to, you know, veer off in any direction as we can. It's made from a solid block of recycled plastic. So there's no veneer, there's no edge banding that peels off and water gets in and the MDF laminate swells and you have to chuck the whole thing out. And it's really durable. So you can drive a truck over clean stone and it will spring back. You can smash it with a hammer and it will not break. And when we have visitors in Critical, I always go, hey, have you got 50 hits? If you crack it, I'll give you $50. and I don't tell them, hey, if they don't crack it, well, you actually owe me $50. Nah. So clean stone is designed to be a sustainable, durable, and beautiful alternative to laminates, engineered stone, timber-based panels, composites, used for, you know, non-permanent fixtures, decorative panels, tabletops, inbuilt joinery, cabinetry, covering surfaces, decorative wall panels, decorative ceiling panels, even floors and bathrooms and wet areas. Anything that's non-permanently fixed to a building, clean stone can do.
And in terms of that, you know, raw material, the single-use plastics and the like that you're going in, I reckon they're going to look back in the future, eh? And they're going to go, these humans of this age were pretty out of it. They went to all this effort to extract this oil that was like a, you know, resource that took millions of years to get into its form. And they destabilized countries and started wars and, you know, had this massive economic engine. And then they get it back and they have these amazing facilities that turn it into these phenomenal uses.
Yeah.
And then they just chuck them out.
Yeah.
And it's like the actual raw ingredients in there are quite amazing. Like, you know, plastic gets a bad rap. But it's pretty amazing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like, how are you able to help create, like, more, you know, that value so that people actually start to look at these things for the value they hold?
Well, I can probably answer it in three ways. The first way I answer it, bro, is that, you know, if we go back to the fuck-a-puppa of plastics, right? Like, plastics were never designed to be a single-use material. It's actually a wonder material. Like, it's amazing. It's meant to be last. It's designed to last lifetimes. And it's only at somewhere in the, sort of in the mid-century where manufacturers realized that they can make more money mass-producing single-use plastics. That's where sort of the I suppose, kind of like the co-puppa of his initial intent kind of veered off in many ways. So think about your Tupperware. You know, you probably got your grandparents, if they were your cousins, your aunties and uncles, like they still have Tupperware and it's just good. And so in many ways, you know, with Critical, we're trying to change the corridor to return plastics back to its first principles, that this is meant to be a durable material that lasts a lifetime. And innate, we're trying to return that to its original, I guess, fuck-a-puppa was made for. So now the second part on our part, bro, is that we deliberately pick the markets, like in the construction space, where the value of construction products, there's a massive spectrum to play with. So you have in Bunnings, you go and buy a bit of like timber, a bit of like sheet of ply for like $80, you know, like $40 sometime. But you also go into this other end where people will spend $50,000 to secure a Caesar stone or Ponamu, you know, like tabletop kind of a thing too. So it's a really ductile market to be able to communicate the value of clean stone. And the other thing is that, like, when you're thinking about buildings, you're thinking about longevity, you're thinking about durability. Buildings typically don't get stripped out or seen as single use. So to be able to have a material to perform and to showcase in already an area, a market where the value range is very high, gives us the ability to actually upcycle the materials and changing behaviors. Like if you, you know, between you and I, if we were sitting on a clean stone tabletop right here, right now, it changes your understanding of how we can use and think about plastics too. So I suppose those are the three ways that, yeah.
Yeah, because we don't notice the plastics around us, right?
It's everywhere.
On a veneer or on a tabletop. No. And so how did you actually go about, you know, once you realized you were onto something and that, you know, with your understanding of architecture and materials, like something that could play that role, how did you go about getting those first customers and first partnerships and establishing the company?
Yeah, so I'll probably say, you know, like, first of all, like, hats off to like companies and brands that's been in the circular economy and sustainability space for a long time. Like, you know, we're standing on their shoulders. You know, they've championed the awareness of the circular economy and sustainability. Where, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, the corridor around this is not where we are today. It's much harder to get that kind of traction, you know, 15, 10 years ago. So luck is on our side, really, you know, to launch in this period of time. What was that part of your question again?
Yeah, how did you get those first people to be using it and getting these products into market and get those first partnerships?
Yeah. So there's two ways that we've always sort of done critical. One is that, like, so we've noticed over the last, particularly over the last 5 years, big organizations are experiencing pressure from their investors and a new generation of customers, pushing them to be sustainable. So millennials, I believe, by 2030, will control over, this number, but trillions, like the trillions of dollars of the global economy, right? And the way that the purchasing power of millennials is, I put my money back where my values are. And if we then look at our kids, the next generation is even more hardcore. But I think this intergenerational shift, it was point A, because that then brought about and put pressure on massive organizations or household brands to actually invest in sustainability. We're actually putting pressure and questioning them, where is that McDonald's toy or where is that plastic product and packaging go at the end of life? And you're either with us, you do something about it, or we stop buying your products. So that's been something that's really positive. We're also seeing shifts in government, right, and in procurement of large organizations too. So, for example, in governments and in big organizations, because of this pressure from investors and customers, they've, you know, subscribed to Green Star. So in the procurement of all future building, we want to have minimal carbon impact and minimal impact on building material waste landfill. So these are the forces that are on our side to be able to then push and force, not force, but, you know, kind of encourage designers and building professionals to actually, and building product manufacturers like ourselves, to help move into that future as it becomes more and more relevant and dominant. And it's such a good thing, you know, and given the recent experiences we've had with climate disaster, with floods and tornadoes and extreme weather events, we're actually, you know, we're probably running a little bit behind on that, to be fair, and we're running out of time. Yeah.
And you mentioned the tornado there. Tell us what happened there. As you know, pretty early on into the company starting to have its own serious operations, What happened?
Yeah, man. So what do we do? The first 4 to 5 years, we bootstrapped Critical, the first generation, by taking over a Wesley Intermediate School's wood workshop. So we sort of decked out the old 1940s wood workshop that probably hasn't been updated for a while, with, you know, material science. It turned into a lab, basically, and we were prototyping, you know, the process and the tech to be able to make it work. We then, while we were doing that, we were in front and pitching, you know, all the corporates and the customers. And we were like, hey, look, we understand that in your sustainability report that you released in 2018, you have a target of zero plastics in landfill by 2030. We think we can help you with that. And to our surprise, you know, quite a few of them goes, yeah, let's do it, kind of thing. So we had enough momentum, we had enough projects or social proof to then go, let's raise a friends and family round. So we apply for the StartMate Accelerator. They take usually every year. There's about 500 startups that apply from Aussie and New Zealand, but they only take in about 16, and we were really lucky to be one of the 16. They invested. They're backed by Blackbird sort of ventures, as well as all sorts of different really, you know, amazing people in the ecosystem across Aotearoa in Australia. So we got into that. That was the first bit of race. We also did a round of friends and family investment round. So like people really just trusting us, taking a really massive risk. So we had about, you know, so 125 plus 250 plus a few grants. We had about maybe 475 grand in terms of the friends and family, this pre-seed investment round. And we put all that money into the first generation microfactory with this factory that we developed and leased in the start of 2021. 2021, and we took over from April, and between April and June, we secured everything and it was ready to go. And I remember we finished, Adam and I finished, we were excited. It was the 16th of June, 2021, and then on the 17th of June, it was a Saturday morning. We were meant to have a meeting with an engineer to talk about, you know, mold designs. And I was driving in on Cavendish, and I was like, "What the fuck? Why is all the power in the petrol station down?" And I was so confused. And then I was driving in, but I was like, "Why do I see bits of roof and cars, you know, like floating in the middle of the road?" And then it dawned upon me as I drove closer, and I heard on the news that there was a giant-ass tornado, and our factory was right in the flight path of that tornado. So the tornado came the day after we set up, ripped open half of our roof like a can opener, destroyed all of our machines, like water damaged everything. We didn't have insurance at the time because we were still like talking about the best assessment process to assess what our premium is. We didn't have that set up, and the tornado came and it flattened us, literally flattened us. So the 6 months then was a lot of favors, every favor we could pull, you know, that we did, and pretty much rebuilt over 6 months and launched again at the start of last year. Yeah. So it was pretty guttering, you know. It's hyper demoralizing when every day for 6 months I have to go into work and just find a swimming pool in our factory with no roof. And I think this one time we got our whānau to come because our factory is right under a flight path. You had this amazing, you know, like roof view of airplanes flying really low to go past. So we're like, "Oh, who wants to come for a swim?" Like,
how do you come through something like that? Like, that must involve, you know, like those are the kind of moments where a lot of people don't keep going, right?
Yeah, bro. I think it's a combination of things, bro. I think. You know, I probably attribute part of that to my own whānau and my own whakapapa and my upbringing, where, you know, my parents grew up at the end of the Cultural Revolution over in China. Like, they were the first few, you know, like they were that first generation that got master's degrees. But when they decided, like many immigrants, to move to Aotearoa, or whatever country that they go to, in the 90s, like your degree and your experience just wasn't. People didn't care, like, you know, probably, yeah. So it's, you know, like, I saw as a young fella, you know, my parents, we didn't have a lot of money growing up, and I saw, you know, my mum and dad, you know, struggle to find their tūranga waiwai, like, their place to stand and retraining and, you know, trying to find work and starting as factory workers, and we didn't have a lot of money growing up. So that resilience from my whānau probably is a huge attribution, you know, to the story. Yeah, and for me, you know, growing up, there was a lot of whakamā about being Chinese. In the 90s, it was a different place for immigrants. I used to get teased and mocked. And it probably wasn't until my Māori mates brought me onto the marae and into tikanga, where through Te Ao Māori, it actually helped me to reconnect with my own Chinese whakapapa. So that's another side of it. My wife, you know, like the hero of the story is not me. The hero of the story is my whānau. And I don't think my wife knew what she was signing up for when we got married, because, you know, we have similar values. We believe in going after what we, you know, what we felt it was important. We believe in a life of service to something greater than ourselves. And, I don't know how we made it work, but probably for about 5 years, three kids, we lived off 35 grand a year, you know, just to be hyper creative so we can fund, you know, our way and our dreams into making this happen. So my whānau is a massive part of that. And the mentorship and mates over the years, like it's a community, right? Like I'm never doing this on my own. Like I've always had people around me and mentors that support me through the hard times. And that's really important, you know, important for me. And so I'm just a product of my environment, I suppose.
That's magic. And we'll be back in a moment with Rui Peng to chat the journey to here, where Critical is today, and where it's going next. Spark is proud to partner with the Sustainable Business Network and the Climate Action Toolbox. The free Climate Action Toolbox can provide you with simple step-by-step guides to measure and reduce your emissions. Help lead the way to a low-carbon future for New Zealand. Visit sparklab.co.nz/sustainability to find out more.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has the lowdown on everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. Join some of the superstars of the investment and business world as they share advice from their time in the US so you can make your mahi count in this massive market. The Investment Fix podcast, brought to you by Invest New Zealand. Tune in today.
Hoki mai anō. Welcome back to Business is Boring. So tell me about the scale of the business today. Like, what are the operations that Critical has going on, and what kind of projects and what kind of scale of stuff are you up to?
Yeah, bro. Maybe I'll start by the bigger picture, and then we can sort of go down and make it more granular. So Critical is a clean tech startup. You know, if we look at plastics pollution and our climate crisis, those are the two biggest challenges of our generation, if not, you know, the generation after us as well. And we are running out of time, you know, to do the right thing. So Critical, you know, we are a deeply ambitious clean tech startup, you know, with the goal of being a $1 billion company in the next 10 years, if not less. And it's not that we all want to do that because we want to be rich and buy mansions, but it's that, like, you need a scalable solution to solve a global crisis. So the way that we want to do that at Critical is right now we have a pilot plant over in Monaco by the airports that we manufacture products. We're already manufacturing and selling products. Probably there's a lot more orders than our current ability to go through them fast enough. So we're investing lots and lots of money with the closing of this current investment round, into building the next generation tech. And I guess our dream is to what we call to create a critical microfactory. So condense our technology into a footprint of a 40-foot shipping container. And the idea is that each shipping container will have the production capacity of 12,000 panels, take 840 tons of plastics out of landfill, and depending on the market that you're selling it to, generate approximately $3 million revenue per 40-foot shipping container. And the goal for us as we grow, you know, grow our tech and grow our product and grow our brand in the market space, is to then, you know, as a Māori-owned company, we want iwi and Māori to have the first right of refusal to become commercial partners to a critical microfactory, so that we can grow and we can help to, you know, uffy the environmental and social, you know, like social impacts that is already pre-written with a lot of iwi themselves. And as we go global, as we go scale, we want to offer First Nation tribal authorities the first right of refusal to become our commercial partners. So the idea is that we want to put a critical microfactory into every city in the world, so that no city will ever again have to ship their plastics overseas to a Malaysia or Asia or somewhere that we don't know, where we don't really know what it's going to become. And sometimes it just gets burnt into our atmosphere. But if we're able to use our tech and create an ecosystem where we can support the environmental growth and economic growth at the regions, you know, with the right partnerships, then we can grow wealth together. And that's the dream. And for us, the product dream of Critical is that, you know, like in 10 years' time, you wouldn't even know. Like, it would just be normal that we're sitting on a clean stone bench, that, you know, this room has a acoustic tile that's made out of clean stone, that kind of thing. So, yeah, that's the ambition, bro, and we'll do our best to execute onto that dream.
And along the way there, like, you know, you've got this part of building out the market for the products and kind of, I guess, making them an obviously better choice and something that, you know, people understand and desire. But also a lot of work around the capability building to produce and manufacture and all of those kind of elements as well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, tell us about some of that work that you do in that capability building.
Yeah, it's a labor of love, eh? You know, it's like it's not easy to try and balance, you know, highly technical mechanical engineering in an R&D program, alongside that material science and formulation development, alongside that manufacturing products and the operations, alongside that marketing and customer support and everything else. It's not easy. It's you know, we're not a very big team. Like, it's probably, if we count everyone that's supporting us in Critical, including contractors, it's probably 10 of us, you know, and all the directors and stuff. So It's a journey, but it's a story of every startup, you know, journey as well. We have to, for us, it's about, you know, it's basically just about everything has to align and match, right? Like it's no good for us if we close a super scalable global deal if the technology takes longer to be able to get there. So I think it's a really fun problem to solve. And yes, sometimes I do not sleep well at night, but it's a journey that I wouldn't ask for, you know, I wouldn't trade for anything else.
In terms of your ideal customers or project, it's all products. Like, yeah, what does that look like?
Yeah, so, well, first of all, is to know that we're not everything to everyone. You know, if someone is purely making a decision and wanting to use materials for a numbers and trying to get the best deal sort of a situation, we're probably not at the stage to service them really well. Who we are looking for are retailers, hospitality brands, you know, any brands that has space, who have already made a commitment and an investment into sustainability, who holds a long-term view of their brand and for long-term outcomes, they want to use CleanStone, where, like, it may be just a little bit more expensive than, say, a standard off-the-shelf building material, but actually, over the course of 5 years, this CleanStone is actually going to be the cheaper product because the total cost of ownership for our material is much lower than just buying a cheap import from overseas and having to replace it multiple times within the same lifespan. So we are looking for brands, retailers that are forward-thinking. You know, H&M is doing some amazing mahi in this space. The Warehouse Group is doing some amazing mahi. We have K1W1 is one of our investors. So, yeah, sustainable brands that are not paying lip service to it but are here for genuine transformation and change.
Yeah, and those costs, if you then start to count the cost of carbon, the cost of replacing them unrecyclable materials at the end of that 5 to 7 year lifespan. If you start to account for these things, which good progressive businesses, right, and a lot more business is going to have to real soon, then those costs drop right down, I imagine.
That's right. That's exactly right. Like, to give you a really simple maybe idea is that one of the things that, you know, perhaps brands do when they get materials, that laminate is a real popular material. Sometimes we import the laminate from China. Maybe you get the laminate, the MDF from China. It's for, so one scenario is like they'll import it, they'll be, I don't know, $50, right? But then they have to then laminate the veneers over it. So then there's the cost of that. So that's maybe, let's say, bring that to about, let's just say $75.
And then you have laminate's some pretty nasty stuff too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they're not the best, because the glue and the binding agents that hold the dust together can be made from formaldehyde. We actually don't accommodate for, first of all, the processes required, and even if that laminate panel is really cheap, within a period of I don't know, 7 to 10 year life cycle, depending on where it's made and how it's made, you might have to replace it. So you're buying two laminate sheets, right? And then you're paying for the logistics, you're paying for someone to take it out, you're paying for someone to like try and fix it, you're paying for shipping, you're paying for landfill. And so the cost does stack up. Whether if you, you know, it's a bit like if you like buy CleanStone, it's a solid block of recycled plastics all the way through. It's already low carbon. It's virtually indestructible and it will fire out last, you know, it will last laminate by a margin of a lifetime, if not like by a margin of at least twice, if not a lifetime. So even if we priced our products, let's just say you're buying a sheet of CleanStone for $400 or $450, and compared to $130 laminate, our products would be the cheaper option by year five. So it'll pay for itself.
And it brings a story.
And it has a story.
It brings a story. It brings an aesthetic. It brings a story and it brings some meaning to a place, right?
Yeah. You can look at the material and see exactly what's gone into it. You can, we can even integrate the plastics from our customers to turn them into CleanStone. They can even send us their plastics and we'll turn them to CleanStone. So every material will tell its story and will never look the same, as well as the durability benefits and the carbon benefits too.
How's the journey been for you having to, you know, go from what was a kind of community project and then into a purpose-led kind of social enterprise and then into a for-profit but for-good enterprise, and then along the way kind of pivot or whatever the kind of trendy words are with that, you know, and then become kind of an international investable kind of unit. Like, how's the journey been for you as this kind of thing keeps giving you a new job every 18 months?
Yeah, it's probably my first answer to that is have very flexible hips. I think it's all a natural progression, right? It's all been a natural progression. Like the kaupapa and the purpose has always remained the same at the heart of it, but the expression is different. I remember matua that I spoke to, Pat Sneeden, you know, this legendary matua that that was part of the early days of with Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei and sort of support the building of Whairawa. He said to me, you know, as I was in my 20s struggling with I had in my 20s, I felt like, man, if I go down this commercial path, like I'm kind of selling out on my community values. And he looked at me dead in the eyes and he said, Rory, like, get that shit out of your head. Like, your commitments to your commercial outcomes is a commitment to your long-term social impact. And of course, that's true, isn't it? Because if we have no means of creating money, like if we wanted to hire, let's just say in Roskill, there's 55,000 people in a population. 15% of that population is classified as not in education, employment, or training. If we want to employ 15% of 50,000 people, we need to turn over $150 million. And so, like, the numbers and how to get there have changed. But why we do what we do, the practice of kaitiakitanga and uplifting the Māori of Te Taiao and our moana, as well as being good tipunga and ancestors so that our tamariki and our mokopuna can thrive for thousands of years, that's all been the same since day one. Mm.
Yeah, amazing. And having that purpose and that kaupapa and that vision, it helps drive you, right?
It does, bro. And it certainly makes the days where isn't every founder will tell you, bro, like it's not easy. There are hard days. But having a clear purpose and knowing your why, oh man, there's this beautiful story, Justice Joe Williams told. I remember him telling this. I did a program called Leadership New Zealand, and he was the speaker at the end of our time together. And he told the story of how the Polynesians or Māori navigated the Pacific, Asia Pacific, to get to Aotearoa. At the time, 800 years ago, was akin to man traveling to the moon. Like the feat of the way that he told that story. And I suppose the principles that guide that story, which was like in 1970s, Nainoa Thompson wanted to learn the ancient art of Polynesian navigation without using instruments to go from Hawaii to Tahiti Nui. Like he had to learn and obtain all these skills. But one of it was you have to imagine your destination or the island that you're traveling to. You need to have to imagine and see that island clearly and have it in the back of your head, because if you don't, and you're in a waka, and you're a navigator, and shit is tough, you can't see the land, there's this overcast, and waves are hitting you, running out of food, your crew will look to you on where to go. And if you don't see your island, you will die, because you're the navigator, and your crew will die too. So in many ways, I take lessons, from the journey of my ancestors, of the journey of my para-ancestors. I feel like even though that might be 4,000 years of separation, Chinese and Māori's probably, more Māori probably all come from China in some stage, but so I take lessons from, people that has come before me, and they remind me, of what to do in the hard times.
What advice would you have for people who are wanting to solve a problem and are wanting to make impact at scale?
I think, first of all, it starts, start at the at the Wairua level, and then we'll bring it down into making it really pragmatic. So probably on a Wairua level is actually about understanding, man, it sounds real cheesy when we say this, bro, but it actually sounds like it's about knowing who you are, knowing where you're from, knowing your whakapapa, and what you are called to do. Like, what is... what is your kaupapa? What is your purpose, right? And having a clear vision, that is really important, first of all. And then it's about doing the preparation to be able to get there. So I just probably, falling back into the, I'm not an expert in Polynesian navigation, so I'm just quoting from what Justice Joe Williams sort of told. But it's about understanding, it's about knowing, having a clear vision, know where to take your waka, and then preparing, doing the hard work and the preparation to be able to get there. However, the caveat here is that do the preparation, do the hard work, But if you're still not sure at the end and when you're ready to take off, just go anyway. And you'll figure it out as you go. What that means for us at Critical, I think, it's real practical wisdom here. Like having a part-time job, like that's really important for any founder because you never know. Like you really never know when something is going to take off enough for you to use your venture to support your Infano. So having, you know, keeping your part-time job for as long as you can is really important. Having a good co-founder, you know, where your values align, but they're also complementary to your skills, is also really important, right? Like you never journey alone on this path. And then I suppose the third thing is just consult and have a community of mentors and teachers, people who's done the journey themselves, who's a bit further along than you. And have people to be able to just to share, you know, the burden and the load with emotionally and over time. Those are all very important, yeah.
Yeah, love it. And as a final thought, what will success be for you personally and for Critical as a company or an idea in the world?
So the first one for us is it's about ending plastics pollution. You know, we don't want to see plastics go into landfill or ending up in our moana anymore. Another big part of that will give me, you know, like, you know, by the end of my life, I'll be pretty stoked about is the ability using our business to give people a second chance at work, at meaningful work as well as we scale. The third part is providing the construction sector with a really beautiful, long-lasting material that, you know, actually uplift the aspirations of designers and architects who wants to do the right thing as well as create beautiful spaces. Like, I think the two goes hand in hand, and then to lower carbon so that, you know, I know that when I die, I can leave, I can contribute to leaving Papatua Nuku in a better place so that our kids can actually thrive. Just returning to those four values for us and seeing it happen or seeing a contribution, a dent being put into that will go a long way for me.
That's magic. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story and your work, and I can't wait to see where you take it next and the journey from here. So thank you so much. That's Rui Ping of Critical. Kia ora.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
So thank you to Rui. Thank you to you for listening and for everyone who helps make this happen, like our producer, Te Aihe Butler. Do follow Business is Boring wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to rate and leave a review if you like what we do. E no hora.
From the Spin-Off Podcast Network, that was Business is Boring. Brought to you by SparkLab. Make sure you're following Business is Boring wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information on SparkLab, visit sparklab.co.nz. Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today. The Spin-Off Podcast Network.